It's April in Tucson and probably everywhere else too. But that means it's time for another cutting edge, razor sharp, and generally very pointy episode of Arizona MCAST. This month, we put on our tinfoil hats and listen to the voices in our head discuss one of the greatest controversies in emergency medicine, thrombolytics in acute ischemic stroke. We finally let Brian's freak flag fly as our resident EM conspiracy theorist delves into the literature, the history, and the heated debate that you will eventually face on your own. Will all of your thrombolytic questions be answered? Probably not. Is this a better discussion than any other EM podcast out there? Meh, maybe. But will it give you a basic understanding of the playing field that you're going to step onto in your next shift? Absolutely. So block out the radio waves that the CIA is transmitting to your brain and focus in on some easy MCAST. So we've been doing our peer review for over a year now. We've been presenting actual evidence-based medicine, and we feel like we have a fairly good product with this podcast. We've got people like Brian Drummond, who's here. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Aaron. How are you?
We've got Chris Williams.
Howdy.
Joining us again.
Thank you.
We've got people that give some wonderful opinion, some great insight. So we felt it's finally time to tackle one of the big medical dogmas and myths and scary topics to discuss at cocktail parties. We're going to talk about stroke, and I'm going to let Brian off of the leash. And, you know, maybe edit a few things, you know, but mostly just expletives and grunting noises.
I think a couple of weeks ago, last time we did this, you had something about just give them the lytics, and that was my tagline. I think it's still the same. I haven't changed it. All conditions.
Yeah. I wanted to edit that out of context and make that your ringtone when you call. So we're going to talk about stroke. Stroke is a devastating disease. It's something that affects a fair amount of people. We've set up entire hospitals to be stroke centers, to be centers of excellence with stroke. We're looking into not just medical therapy, but surgical therapy with some of these retrieval devices that you can fish up into the artery and remove it. It's a devastating disease that we don't have a whole lot we can do for. And the one medication that we do use is the clot buster. You know, we've got some kind of thrombolytic that we give that just like it used to do with MIs before we would go in and percutaneously stent and balloon, it would cause not just the positive effects that we would hope it would in the heart, it causes lots of negative effects as well. And you've got something that doesn't remodel as well as the heart in the brain. So we're going to talk a little bit about stroke. And more than actually talking about and tackling the pathophysiology of stroke and the pharmacokinetics of thrombolytics, we're going to talk about the decision you need to have at the bedside with the patient or their family. So, Brian and Chris, I'm going to pose this patient to you. You have a 68-year-old female who comes to the ED after 45 minutes of right-sided hemiparesis and aphasia. They're not able to communicate with you. Their NIH score is 12, and for all intents and purposes, they appear to have a stroke. The family comes to the bedside, and you tell them, after getting your head CT and doing some labs and your EKG, you go, your loved one has had a stroke. And the family says, doctor, I have no idea what to do. What can be done for this stroke?
I'll tackle that. I'm a little bit more liberal with my TPA use than I think Brian is. And I came from an institution. In residency, guess how many times I gave TPA?
How many?
A zero.
Zero.
Zero times. I had one case as a third-year resident that went directly to neuro... interventional radiology for like direct thrombolysis in the brain. And at that time, I did a little bit of research thinking, you know, if you can directly access the artery in the brain, give a little directed TPA, open that up, and the patient does well, then maybe there is a place and a role for TPA. And lo and behold, the research does not show that. And so that was my first kind of eye-opening to, wow, maybe TPA is not this panacea that we thought it is. Maybe it is like MI, like Aaron said, that we just haven't defined what subgroup really benefits the most from TPA in stroke. So I had that as my backdrop and my default. Maybe TPA isn't the end-all be-all. And then I go to Texas, and we're the stroke center for a very large catchment area, and the culture there is TPA for everybody. And it became apparent within my first month that if I wasn't giving TPA, I was quite an outlier. And it was really easy to give. I had a piece of paper, and I wrote, give TPA per protocol, and signed it. And it just happened. So it wasn't difficult for me to do. And but I called the neurologist every single time I had a patient come in with stroke symptoms. And after a couple weeks, he finally kind of called me out and said, you seem to think that you need my permission to give TPA. And I said, well, I thought I did. He said, no, you're the doctor. You've seen the patient. You decide if they need TPA, and then you can admit them to my service, and I'll see them in the morning. You only need to call me if you have a question about whether you should give it, because it's, you know, it's different than normal. But if they're meeting criteria, just give it. I'll see them in the morning. And if there's a complication, obviously call me, and I'm happy to get involved, but you don't need to call me for every patient. So at the end of my one year there, I totaled up an estimation of how many patients I had pushed TPA on, and I ended up with 60. So I think I gave it 60 times in that one year.
You can't see right now, but Brian's crying.
I've never given TPA.
And that blows my mind, right? Because
For stroke.
Like Aaron mentioned, there are patients that know that there is this magic medication called a clot buster. Well, that sounds amazing, right? My loved one has a clot, and you can bust it. So do it. And they come into this discussion with an emotion and hope. And you're viewing your role as making this as unemotional of a decision and taking away that hope and making it a little more realistic. And that's difficult to do. And we can talk about this in a few minutes here, but medical legally, I was always told that you're more likely to be sued for giving TPA. Not actually true from what I found. You're more likely to be sued for not giving it. And so you add that added component of risk to us.
The interesting thing on that, Chris, is so if you look at the legal risk is actually still higher for giving it, because what they quote in those is the number of cases in each one, but they don't tell you the denominator, because most patients don't get TPA. So even though they're sued more, that overall suing rate for not giving a decision is less than those who give TPA, because the denominator in those who get TPA is much less. So the lawsuits are less in the TPA group, and they're more in the not giving TPA group, but the denominators are different. So the percentage for every time you make that decision is actually less.
So they give the raw numbers and the percentages, and they were pretty stark. And this is in a 2013 paper, and I think the earlier papers showed exactly what you're saying. It's interesting. This is a paper that is not done by physicians. This is actually done by lawyers, and they go through, for example, LexisNexis Legal, Google Scholar, Medline, Embase, Westlaw, different legal databases, and then from that they do a meta-analysis and are able to go through, I think, 789 stroke cases. And then from that, they found 46 in which the case really came down to whether you gave TPA or not. And they only used those 46 cases in it. So it's still not a very large, you know, sample size, but that's their kind of legal meta-analysis.
And I think that the legal is definitely a concern. I mean, and to answer Chris's or Aaron's initial question, and what do we do with this patient? I think the first thing is defining whether they have a stroke or not. Mm-hmm. I would start with a CT, and you know, the real question to me is bleed or no bleed, right? Because we know probably in strokes, 80 to 90% are ischemic, and the others are hemorrhagic or other causes. So I want to exclude those off the bat in this young lady that's coming in. The next thing would be of those, and we know even though stroke rates are declining over the last few years, the mortality rate is declining, it's still significant, 15 to 45% in these, but the use of TPA in general of all comers is still only 2 to 3%, and patients are becoming more aware of the clot busting drug. But if you look at the literature in terms of how many patients even know it exists, it's still in the general population no more than 20%. And a lot of times it's 10% of the patients knowing. So I think when this presentation of what do we do, doctor, is very common because it's something that a lot of patients just are unaware. And I think we know in so many realms in medicine and how we're treating patients, they just don't know a lot about what we're doing. And I mean, this is just what we do, and they don't even know with a headache I should take Tylenol or Motrin, and this is just, and so now we're talking a stroke, and this is devastating, and someone's changed their behavior, and they're not responsive. So I think this is a whole-on discussion, and you know, leading from that into the TPA, non-TPA, I think we still miss, even if they have a stroke, there are certain things that are important, that are cheap and easy to do. Things like speech involvement, aspiration precautions, head of bed elevation. These are all easy things you can do at bedside. Glucose control management, but they're not sexy. They don't cost money. They don't make money for the hospital. Drug companies don't make money off these, but they've been proven over time.
You don't think that would be an effective commercial? Come to Banner University Medical Center. We'll raise your head of the bed 30 degrees.
And have speech and nutrition come by.
That's right. Well, you know, maybe you want to just be fed. So some people want to be fed and talk to their head up. So, you know, with these interventions, these are good interventions, and they make a difference. And part of, you know, with this whole discussion, stroke centers, well, what do stroke centers do? They bring attention to the subject. What do we see with sepsis? Well, we had a lot of people dying. Then all of a sudden, Manny Rivers came out of the paper, and then all of a sudden, now we're having sepsis protocols and sepsis centers of excellence. And we brought attention to a subject that we were not paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And so with stroke, the same thing. If I pay attention to you and watch you closer, you do better. Almost universally in medicine. And we did the same thing with MIs. And we create these centers. So is it the creation of the center or a specific aspect of that center we have to address? And I think the lytics are part of that discussion. Is that the major difference, or is there something else in the center that's making things better?
Absolutely agree. And as I've matured a little bit over the past couple years and had an opportunity to learn from you and review some of the literature, and as these other studies have come out, ECAS-3, and that's the other thing, do you quote the initial NINES data, or do you quote, you know, subsequent studies? Do you quote any studies when you talk to patients? And I'm curious, how in-depth do you go into explaining these things to patients and their families? Do you just say, here's the data, make up your mind, or do you say, here's the data, and here are some things that I think actually do contribute to the improvement of stroke sufferers, such as more time at the bedside, more intense nursing care, yada yada, and that's why I think you'll get better. But honestly, it may not actually be the TPA. And how far do you take it as far as trying to educate your patient, or do you play it by ear?
I will play it by ear. I think depending on how they present and what their requests are, you know, and how much they truly want to know. And sometimes people shake you off and don't want to know anymore as you start to get into details. But I will go, like, these are long discussions. This is pull up, not the rolly chair. This is pull up the chair with arms and no rollers, and you grab a seat, and we're going to have a discussion. So I will go into significant detail. I'll start with, I think if you look at all the studies, the inner cerebral hemorrhage rate is 6 to 7%. Mm-hmm. So the number needed to harm for giving TPA is 1 in 17, 1 in 16. And that's just about on every study. So So that's a pretty good number. I think I can quote patients. I think that the overall benefit rate, and I will bring, and I'll, I can give Aaron this as well. Joe Lex, who's a really smart guy, he's been around the block much more than any of us combined, and out of Philly had done an educational tool on AEM's website. And it, I use that because it's a very graphic representation of the NINS data and taking the best situation and showing that in 18 patients, 12 will not be affected of their good or bad outcome, and only 3 will be affected. Of those 3, 2 will have an improved outcome, and 1 will have a bleed in their head. And I show this to patient, and it's a 2-page printout, and I show them, and I said, I want you to read this because I think you need to know what is involved in this drug. This isn't Tylenol. This isn't a cold pack to your knee. This is has significant harms, and it may have benefits. I can't, you know, and I tell them my opinion, and I go over some of the data, and I do as much as they, you know, I feel that they're interested in. But I think that, I tell them, if you want it, we'll find someone to give it to you. I think we can get you the drug, but I want you to be informed about this decision, because if you bleed into your brain, that's not a normal thing. People don't do well when they bleed into their brain. And if you look at in the studies, the people that die of those that bleed is about 60% on average. So it's not just like, oh, you got a little ditzel bleed. Grandma's going to go walk her dog tomorrow. You know, this is a significant bleed. So when I have the potential to harm someone and I have other things that may benefit them, that's where I come in and weigh. And I want this to work. Trust me, I want TPA to work. I believe that there is a role somewhere for this drug. Intra-arterial, I was with you, Chris. I thought that was great. But I haven't seen it yet.
Right.
You know, and so this is hard. It's hard for me to tell a patient I want to give you something that I truly do not believe in. And we know that this comes down to belief. But I don't see it in the evidence. And my belief is formed by my reading of the 12 major articles in the evidence.
So let's talk about a couple of those. We don't have to go through every one of the 12. But let's talk about some of the big ones that people kind of stake their claim on.
Yeah. So, I mean, all this started back in 1995. They started coming out. Mast Italy was the first study in Lancet. And if you look at their conclusions, they talk about the routine use of thrombolytics should not be or should be avoided. I mean, that's one of their quotes out of the article. It didn't show any benefit. There was an ECAS-1. ECAS-1 is the European collective. You're going to hear of an ECAS-2 and an ECAS-3 upcoming. That was in JAMA 1995. That was a higher dose of TPA, so some people throw out this article and say, well, it was higher than our normal dose. But they looked at it, and there was no mortality or modified rate and significant difference. So again, they didn't that was not a positive effect for TPA. Then the New England Journal came out, which was the NINS article, and this is the one that everyone quotes, right? So NINS is interesting because it came out in 95, but it's actually 2 studies in one. And there's a NINS 1 and there's a NINS 2. Now this is where we developed the TPA dose, the alteplase dose that we use today of 0.9 mgs per kg. And the initial this was an industry sponsor, Genentech. So I think we should be honest that there are 2 companies that are the same companies, Genentech and Boehringer Ingelheim. Boehringer Ingelheim paid for my chalet in Germany, and I'm very happy with all the money I've received for them in this podcast. We'll probably stop those funds coming in. But Boehringer Ingelheim's in Europe and Genentech's in the United States. So if you hear those, they're the ones who make alteplase. But the NINS study was 2 parts. So the first part, they did not show any benefit. There is a part 2, which is the quoted part, and that's the one that shows benefit. And with the NINS trial, there are some significant differences to know. So in baseline characteristics in NINS 1 and 2, there were sicker patients in the placebo arm. So with NINS 1, the initial primary outcome they wanted was a statistically a significant difference of greater than 4 of an NIH stroke scale. So like in our patient here, we're talking about an NIH stroke scale, I think you said of 11, mm-hmm. Aaron. And so they would want to see that come down to 7. So a significant difference. Now, if you start at baseline with a sicker population in your placebo, their NIH stroke scales were higher. And they were by about a point on average. So they both had to drop a significant, at least 4 points. There was no significant difference in NINS 1. You look at NINS 2, they changed the primary outcome. Why? Because they wanted something significant, right? So they changed in NINS 2 to a different outcome. And that outcome was a modified Rankin scale. And you're going to hear all these scoring scales. So you're going to hear a modified Rankin. You're going to hear a Berthel index. There's an Oxford handicap scale. So there's all these scoring scales used in these trials. And the hard part is with all these different scales, different primary outcomes, different times that they're doing in these scales, it's hard to do a good meta-analysis of these trials. So if you hear a systematic review or meta-analysis of this, it's probably not accurate. You have to individually look because they're so heterogeneous. So it's hard to look at all these trials together. So NINS 2 only had 332 patients, and they were looking for a modified Rankin score of minimal or no deficits. So in some of these, it's 0 and 1 is minimal or no. Some is 0, 1, and 2. Some are 0. In NINS 1, they wanted at least a 20% difference at 30 days. So they're looking at this, and when they did this, they found a difference, approximately 11% difference. So they compared their 0 to 1 modified Rankin compared to everything else. And a 0 to 1 is pretty functional. 0, we're all here in the room at a 0. A 1 is maybe I have some numbness, but I can do anything I want to do. Whereas a 6 is death, right? And a 4 is a significant disability. So 2 is like maybe I limp, but I can't run a marathon, but I can do a lot. And 3 is someone's got to help me.
I rode my bike to work yesterday, so I'm actually a 1.
Because what's the deficit, Aaron?
Well, it's just some numbness. I'd rather not talk about it.
So if you look at NINS 2, the big thing that they're commenting on is that 11% modified Rankin scale difference. And it's there. It's there if they cut the numbers that way and they showed it. So that was the second part of the study. So when this study came out, it changed everything, right? The quote that they say, the most obvious difference between our study and the other larger trials is that we focused on time. So now we have changed our paradigm in stroke. Time is brain. And that was a big shift. Mm-hmm. That was not there. I mean, I think for all of us, we have heard time is brain.
And it made sense.
I heard that.
Right? It made sense physiologically and pathophysiologically.
We hear, because of that, time is everything. Time is tissue, time is heart, time is brain, time is testicle. I've heard all of these things as far as relating to ischemic pain. So.
Right. And so we thought this was it, right? And the study was proving it. So that was 1995 in December. 96, New England Journal, Mast Europe comes out. That shows actually harm. They stopped. They wanted 600 patients. They had to stop it early because they were killing people. The next major study was the ASK. This is the Australians in 1996 in JAMA. They looked at streptokinase. And they actually looked for death and disability. And they had to stop early because they were killing people. And Mast Europe was also streptokinase. And we can ask, why are they doing streptokinase? We know it's not streptokinase that works. We know it's alteplase that works. Well, if you look at the cardiac literature, lytics, all of them worked. Mm-hmm. Why am I using streptokinase? Streptokinase in the cardiac literature had the lowest intracranial bleed rate. In stroke, we worry about intracranial bleed. So I'm going to use the drug that has the lowest rate, and it's cheaper. And somehow we care about cost in Europe and Australia, but United States, we want to spend lots of money. So we don't care about cost. So you're like, why are they doing streptokinase? That's crazy. This is why. And it made sense. It made sense at the time. In alteplase, in the cardiac data, had the highest intracranial bleed rate. But it's got a good company behind it and makes lots of money. Oh, wait, sorry. You can edit that out too, Aaron.
I'm just going to add a little turkey.
So the next day, so ASK and JAMA showed no evidence. But in 1996, even though these articles came out, the FDA approved alteplase for stroke within 3 hours. And I don't think the FDA has made any changes in that, and I don't think they've extended any times of an FDA approval. We've talked about it in guidelines and other places of time changing, but I don't think the FDA since 1996, so in 20 years, we haven't changed any other approvals for Alteplase, I think. And you can...
You're right. ASAP has changed.
Right. ASAP has changed. And I think that's a good discussion we'll talk about later. There was an ECAS 2. We talked about ECAS 1. This was in Lancet 98. They also looked for a modified Rankin of 0 to 1 at 90 days. They didn't see any difference. There was no statistical difference in that. The problem is most of these studies are only 300 to 600 patients. These are not big studies. If you look at the total lytic literature in general, it's only 8,000 patients. In thrombolytics for MI, we used 60,000 patients to know that an ST elevation was significant. We found that ST depression, and we gave lytics to, caused harm. And we also know that if we had normal EKGs, because about 5 to 10% of the patients in the lytic for MIs had normal EKGs, and they were given lytics, which is kind of wild, right? I mean, can you imagine giving lytics to
In retrospect. Clinically, maybe, oh, my patient looks like they're having a heart attack. Even maybe their tropes were elevated.
We have this great drug that is going to bust up their clot.
That's right.
You know, busted. So, yeah, it's some of this stuff we look back in retrospect. It's, you go, I cannot believe that we did that.
And if you doubt that we're not going to be in that situation, hopefully not 10 years or 15 years, but maybe 5 years from now, we look back at how we're treating stroke now, we'll say, I can't believe we gave everybody TPA.
We used to put people on rat poison. Rat poison? It has the word poison in the name. That's what we used to do. So all kinds of stuff that we do is, it's going to be 10-15 years, absolutely crazy. And then 10-15 years after that, that's going to be crazy. So,
yeah, the historical picture, I think, is important, though, because then we start to understand why we're doing our practices today based on this literature and other things. So ECAS 2 came out, Lancet, 1998, so TPA has already been approved. It actually showed no significant difference. But then they did a post-hoc analysis, and they changed it from a modified Rankin of 0, 1 to 1, 2, and 3. Then they said, oh, yeah, it's definitely a difference, and so they change primary outcomes. And you're going to see that in a lot of these, a lot of these papers, they're changing primary outcomes. They halt the study midway through. They change something, which, it's just kind of sketchy. If the drug works, run the study and show the drug works. And we should see that over and over again, or at least trends. Maybe it doesn't reach statistical significance, but every study shouldn't be stopping them for harm or things like that. JAMA in 1999, Atlantis B came out. This was actually the NINS protocol. This was the same NINS protocol as that study, and it was started at the same time. Why was it delayed? Because they were looking for the 0 to 6 hours. They wanted a bigger time window indication. So they had started this. And why did Atlantis B come out before Atlantis A? Because Atlantis B, they're like, oh, well, that was 3 to 5 hours that we used. But we were worried about the 5 to 6, and people were dying. So then we excluded those. But then we still looked at 3 to 5, and we still had people dying, so we stopped the study. Again, this is weird, right? This is weird stuff. So then Atlantis A came out in stroke of 2000, and they took the whole 0 to 6 hours of the initial, not the cut up 3 to 5 hours, and that showed that, again, they stopped because they were killing people early in this. So this study was also stopped. So 2002, the European Medical Agency, that's our FDA in Europe, so they finally approved Alteplase after all this. So 96, 2002, they make the change, but they had two conditions. They wanted a randomized controlled trial for greater than 3 hours, and then they wanted to follow safety data. So this is where ECAS 3 comes out. This is the Europeans now. This is their follow-on study for the approval. And this came out in New England Journal 2008, and they looked at 3 to 4 hours, and that was the initial study. And then they found we're not getting that many people in this study. So we probably should, midway through, they added an extra half hour. So they went from 3 to 4.5 hours. Well, in that last, they got 40% of their patients in the trial in that extra half hour, adding it in. So, and they looked at this. Again, this is industry sponsored, but they only
only got 800 patients. Again, there's still, these are low numbers. Primary outcome was a three-month modified Rankin of 0 to 1 versus everything else. And they looked at this, and they showed, again, there was a difference in the placebo. The sicker patients were in the placebo than TPA. But they showed a primary difference of 7%. And you're going to see this quoted. This was, there were more people that had a better modified Rankin of 0 to 1, 7% difference. So that's a number needed to treat if we take 7% of probably 1 in 16, 1 in 15, something like that. Now, the problems, again, with the ECAS-3 and the NINS is if I start with a sicker patient, my NIH stroke scale will be higher, but my modified Rankin will also be higher. So if nothing happens, it benefits the one that started in a better group. So these are some of the questions that people have. But they don't show the, you know, they'll show the modified Rankin data. You'll see those charts, and that's what people look at. So ECAS-3, again, this is the second trial that should benefit. Highly touted. It's in the stroke literature. The neurologist will quote this. This is out there saying we've got to give it. There was a DS2 in 2009. This was for desmoplase. It's a different drug than alteplase. It didn't show any benefit. There was one last trial, and this is probably, if you had to read a trial, this is the trial I think you should read, and this is the IST-3 trial, and this was in Lancet of 2012, and why, this is an alteplase versus placebo, 0 to 6 hours, and this trial tells you, I think, more than any other trial because it had 3,000 patients. It had over three times any other trial size, and they actually wanted 6,000 patients for this trial but couldn't get the numbers. Now, they use an Oxford scale. We kind of mentioned that before, but this was a double-blinded, randomized trial initially. Then it was stopped. Then it became an open-label trial. So it's, there's a lot of methodological issues with this trial, but the good thing is I think it took patients that we see on a regular basis. It took the old patients. It took sick patients. It didn't, I mean, they didn't care what your age was. They didn't care what your NIH stroke scale. And some of the other trials were minimizing. And we said, oh, yeah, don't give TPA to old people because they're going to bleed and die. They said, no, bring it on. We'll take all old people. And so some of the interesting findings here were that over half their patients were greater than 80. So if you take 1,500 greater than 80 patients, no other stroke trial tells you about 80-year-olds in TPA. This one probably does. The if you look at their primary outcome, which they modified a little bit in the middle bit, and they comment on it, because they took initially a modified Rankin of 0, 1, and 2, and they changed that. They showed that, and they said, you're right, there is no significant difference in that. But if we take a 0 and 1, there is a significant difference. So they published both of those results. But, you know, all that besides, the people got TPA, died earlier at 7 days, right? But maybe this is what TPA is doing, right? We kill off the ones that are sick that are going to die, and then the ones that are left show a better result, right? So we kill off the ones early, and then the other ones are good. Oh, I'm going to hear a gobble after this.
If you talk to a lot of physicians, that was the way that we felt it should be, right? You would say, you would see the patient in their dire strait of inability to express themselves or probably unable to care for themselves for the rest of their life. And you would turn to your fellow colleague and say, if I'm ever in that situation, you better push TPA because I want to either get better or die.
And you give me a double dose, yeah. Right? And so it's interesting, some of the data. The 80-year-olds did better in this trial. So we said, no, we're not going to take care of them. The 80-year-olds did better. The other thing, the people less than 80 did worse with TPA. You know, that's kind of a fascinating thing. The other thing is, does time matter? And so this is probably the biggest thing. If you look in, and there's a chart in there in IST-3, but does time matter? If you look at the 0 to 3, benefit. If you look to the 3 to 4.5 hours, harm with TPA. And if you look at 4.5 to 6, benefit. This makes no physiologic sense whatsoever. You know, you cannot explain this away. How do you go, like, oh, yeah, if I'm at, wait, I guess you wait, right? You wait till 5 hours if you're at the 4-hour mark before I give you TPA. That doesn't make any sense.
To be fair, what we know about the physiology of the brain is reflected in how much we can treat problems with the brain. We know absolutely nothing about the physiology of the brain. It may make perfect physiologic sense, and we just don't know. We go, clearly, this is kind of the same argument. Clearly, that doesn't make any sense, because we know that this is how the brain works. We have no idea how the brain works.
Another evidence of that is why our primary outcomes function at 3 months. When I'm giving a clot-busting drug that's working right now, why isn't it outcome in 3 days?
Right. And,
because it's not there.
Well, and you see it. When people give TPA and the patient gets better in an hour, it's the TPA.
It's a resurrection.
You know, I gave the TPA, they're better at 12 hours. It's the TPA. I gave it 4 days later, or I gave it and 4 days later they're better. See, I'm glad I gave TPA. So to me, that doesn't make sense. But it's also, right, the embolic, this is an embolic event. It's different than a plaque that ruptures with an acute clot, we think, with STEMI. So it's a different, you know, we just don't know. And I completely agree here. I mean, we're trying to understand this, and this is where I think we need more trials, right? We need just more data. What is the group that TPA truly works on? It's trending in a lot of these things. It's showing some benefit. We just don't know. Is it the old patient? Is it the old patient that comes in early because they know they have a very debilitating stroke? Or is it just the sickest patients, right? We know that lytics with MI, the sickest patients, so if I have an anterior wall MI, cardiogenic shock, I do better if I get lytics than someone who just has a mild MI. But part of that is the sicker you are, the more of a chance you have to improve. Someone comes in with a little arm weakness and you give them lytics, who cares? You know, they're probably going to recover most of that arm weakness and do fine whether you give them the lytics or not. But if someone can't talk or walk and is just like off in la-la land and you're going to bring them back, like you said, a resurrection to a normal status or near normal, that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. There's more to gain for those patients.
So great job to Brian. I really have to commend him for going through all of the stroke literature and giving us a really good synopsis. However, this is the part of the podcast I hope you pay the most attention to. Go back, get screenshots of all of those different links, look up the papers, make up your mind for yourself. However, some people have already made up their mind. Some patients have already made up their minds. Some neurologists have already made up their minds. Some hospital administrators and national organizations have already made up their minds. So when you go into this discussion, know that it doesn't have to be a battle, but you do have to be prepared with your patient's best interests in mind. Chris and Brian and I now have a discussion about how to have this talk with our patients. How do we describe the risks? How do we talk to our consultants about it? What are the pros and cons of what we're about to do? This is what really takes years of having this discussion to hone and to have down pat so that you can discuss with your patients.
So you've quoted, what, 11 or 12?
12 articles.
12 articles. How many of those 12 showed a TPA benefit?
Two.
Okay. And so there's 10 more articles now that show either harm or no benefit, and you have to somehow get all of this wealth of information into a patient so that they are now capacitated to make some kind of a decision. That's just not going to happen. And there is a reason that the patient is asking you what to do. They're looking at you and they're paying you to help them make that decision. How paternalistic are you with this, especially in the age we are now where we really want patient-centered, you know, involvement, and knowing that you're not working in a vacuum. You're going to consult a neurologist who's going to come down here, and I've seen it happen. Resident talks to the patient and says, there's this medication I can give you if we give it to you, quoting, you're going to get better, and if we don't give it to you, your stroke will either stay the same or get worse. And then they walk out of the room, and then they push TPA, and this can be a problem. So how do you convey this? How do you build trust with a patient? And I think this is a wonderful point. You brought up the AAM visual aid. I think we underutilize visual aids, and I've done a little bit of lit searching on just explaining risk to patients, and that one of the biggest things they say is actually using visual aids, and it helps endear you to the patient. It shows you care. You took the time to print out information that would make it easier for them to understand. at that point, you're building a bit of trust with the patient. And if I can create like a really basic graph for you, okay, a chart graph. In the y-axis, that's your degree of caring. In the x-axis, that's your degree of competence. And your goal is to convey to the patient that you are both caring and competent. And when those two converge, that's trust. There's also, some degree of affection. Maybe you're very caring, but they don't think you're very competent. Well, you're a nice guy. Or maybe they respect you because you're super competent, but you're kind of a jerk.
I really lean on the first one.
And there's something to be said for that. But your goal is to convey that not only are you caring for their loved one, and I'll use terms like, if this were my grandma, I would do X, Y, or Z. I think that goes pretty far to show that you're caring. The fact that you're even sitting down, so you're showing some degree of caring by sitting down, showing them this visual aid that helps them make a decision, trying your best to convey. But at some point in time, you have to say, this is what I would do, showing some degree of competence because you know the literature better than they do. You don't need to go through all 12 studies, but you need to convey some degree of competence and caring, and then they will trust you.
Right. And I don't think you have to say, I'm going to or not going to give you the drug.
Right.
I think this is perfect for shared decision making, and I try to convey to them there are 12 studies. Two of them showed benefit, four showed harm, and six didn't show benefit or harm. And so I will say I have some concerns about the drug that it may not work. It may work, but I don't know. And I try to be very honest with this. And I also, you know, I put this in my chart, right? I will probably chart more on these patients, especially when you're not giving TPA, about reasons why. And we had conversations. Read this information. If you can't read it, I'll go over it with you. I want you to think about it. Come on back.
Right? I'd love to read it, but I can't hold the paper in my hand because it's paralytic right now.
Right. So, and especially in our case scenario, she's coming with 45 minutes of symptoms. If I believe the time, I have 2 hours and 15 minutes to dick around, and I can do whatever I want to do. Right. As long as I hit by 2:59, if I wanted to push it, I can push it. So I have plenty. Right, this is a long conversation I can have, as opposed to the person that comes in by 2:59. Somehow they're second on the list for CT. I don't know how that happened, and I'm not saying I do these kind of things because that would be wrong and difficult. But really, right, I mean, we know that people don't come in at that time, but I think your visual aids point, Chris, is huge. We know that this exists for chest pain, too. They're starting to put more visual aids, and are you willing to what risks are patients willing to accept? And it's a good way to show them information that's really complex. And quoting numbers, people don't understand numbers, but if you form it in a very pictorial way, it's huge. They can digest that information and make better decisions.
So for the listeners, just Google AAEM stroke risk. First link will be that PDF.
So this will go a little more into how to educate patients on risks. Let's say that this patient or her family is one of that 20% that actually knows there is this clotbuster drug. And I saw those American Heart Association commercials, which is why we came right in. How come she hasn't gotten this drug yet? How do you talk to those patients that say, I've heard of this, I've heard that it works, and I want it now?
Again, I just go over, I sit down with them. I give them my reasons for why I would give the drug or wouldn't give the drug. And I just have a candid conversation with it. And they still demand it. And I still will let them read that literature and show them that. And I said, I'll come back in 15 minutes and we'll talk some more. Because people need to digest. I mean, with anything we do in medicine, you know, you have cancer. All right, you're going to have to digest that, right? You're having a miscarriage. This is a big news. Someone has a stroke and telling them they have a stroke and then talking about a drug that could possibly make them bleed in their brain, that's also a devastating thing. And so I still give them that 15 minutes. Digest it. Let me come back to you. And I sit down and talk. And if they want the drug, no matter what I say, and they believe that this works, I will find a way for them to get the drug. I will call the neurologist and have the neurologist write for it over the phone.
And I've done that. I've said, look, you're going to have to order this. I don't. And I'll tell the patient, I said, I think it's going to harm you more than it's going to benefit you. But I'm happy to have someone else because you want it. I'm going to get that drug for you. So I'm going to have the neurologist on the phone. They're going to give the order to the nurse. They're going to get the admission orders, and we're going to get you upstairs and we'll get you taken care of. And I thank you for, you know, having a discussion with me and being honest with what you would like. So, again, and I comment on in my note why they're, you know, what the patient wants. We discussed this multiple times. Their request is this. I want to satisfy them and make them happy and feel comfortable and that I'm not a complete idiot. And I am caring, right? You're caring and competent at the same time.
So you don't place in the chart that the patient was incompetent and altered and we four-pointed the patient because they wanted TPA. Clearly, they were not of a decision-making capacity.
Well, the thing, Aaron, is no one has done the Haldol to TPA randomized controlled trial. And if we do this, we will see that Haldol performs better than TPA.
At least the same.
I would love to get that by an IRB. I would be the primary investigator on that.
So I've spent some time over the past week or so knowing that we're going to have this discussion, talking to residents and some faculty about how often they actually take an active role in discussing this decision, this risk, the risk benefit with patients and their families. And I feel personally that my role over the few years has gone down. When I first started, every single time I was considering TPA, I had a pretty lengthy discussion with the family and the patient, if able, about this. And as neurology has become a bit more involved, and rightly so, they are becoming a part of the picture earlier in the process. I've kind of stepped back a bit, knowing that there's more than one cook in the kitchen. They're going to have the last laugh, so to speak. They're going to be the ones caring for the patient for the next days to weeks, and allowing them really to make the call. And I wanted to know if other people were doing this too. So I talked to the residents. I asked them how often they have this discussion. The number of residents who said they actually never have this discussion is pretty high. So my question to both of you is as neurology becomes more and more involved earlier and earlier in the care, as hospital policies are now dictating, should we find ourselves backing off and allowing them to make the call? Do we consider ourselves a bit of a counterpoint, maybe like an alternative point of view to how they practice, at least at our institution here?
So I'll answer that one first because I have less experience with it. Given that I do a lot of peds and most of the strokes I see are treated with plasma exchange and just waitful watching upstairs in the PICU. So if I have one of these patients, I honestly have been in the group as well. I've said, well, neurology is going to make the decision. And I've tried to talk with the patients about it a little bit, but I haven't pushed that hard, I'll be honest. One of the reasons that I'm cautious about it is because I feel like patients need to trust the medical system as a whole. And if I go in and let's say I sit down and have a 30-minute discussion complete with graphs and visual aids, and a consultant comes down and says after 10 seconds, yeah, this is what you need, and that other doctor's not right, that's a problem, because who is the patient going to trust? And why am I placing enmity in between me and the consultant? Because the consultant's going to admit this patient. And even though I have spent my 30 minutes, that person is going to spend the rest of that week talking to them. They should have given you TPA. All this time you're spending with rehab, they should have given you TPA.
Absolutely.
You have to swallow nectar.
I've seen it happen.
Right now. They should have given you TPA. In the same right, if neurology comes down, takes the time, talks to the patients about the risks and benefits, and highly recommends TPA, and I come in and say, I think that's a stupid idea, and we'll just wait until you bleed it into your head, that's not good either. So there's a way to do this. And the discussions I have had have been with the 92-year-old who has a high NIH score that also has some significant risks from, or one of the minor risks, and they say, ah, it's not such a big deal. You know what? I'm concerned about this. I'm also concerned this patient has abdominal pain, and they may have actually had a dissection or may have had a AAA, and this will be a clean kill if you give them thrombolytics. So I'll tell you what, we have 45 minutes. I will put this patient on the table, scan the head, scan the chest, abdomen, pelvis, and if that's clear, then we can do it. But I'm not very happy about the prospect. I think this patient may do poorly. I've had one of those patients that did just fine. Within 45 minutes, the TPA, quote, worked, and another patient who died in the MRI. So it's a difficult decision. But I think that we need to do it in unity and not being a contrarian for the sake of saying, well, you know, not everything is roses and sunshine.
Yeah, I have... I've had two people that I have probably been contrary on in the last few years, and part of that was because I thought it was inappropriate and would hurt the patient. And so it was more of a avoiding patient harm. And one was an 80-year-old who syncopized, hit his head, had some resolving speech, and his left arm and leg were not working, but now are working. He had a CT, which was negative. He had a small hematoma on the left side of his face. He has still had speech deficits, long conversation, did visual aids, talked to them. Neurology resident came down. And I had said, I probably would not give TPA at this point to you because your symptoms are resolving, one, and two, you fell and you hit your head. And I think I'd harm you more than I would benefit you. The only thing you have as a deficit right now is a speech deficit, which we can work on. That's what speech therapy is for. And if other things are getting better, that will probably get better as well. You know, you're going the right direction. Neurology resident had wanted TPA and said, you're off your rocker, doc, and told the patient that they needed to get TPA, and they were the neuro doctors, and they know more than me. And I said, okay, that's fine. I said, fair enough. And the patient, I said, let me come back, and came back, and the patient and his wife said, no, speech is very important to him. He wants it to do TPA. I said, that's fine. Neurology wrote for TPA. I got told 20 minutes later because the left side of the face had swollen up, and we stopped TPA, and the patient had a large hematoma in his face. And I just went in and said, how are you doing? I said, I'm sorry the TPA did not work for you. Not as a sarcastic, passive-aggressive SOB.
At least not outwardly.
Outwardly. Inward, I was like, damn right. Stupid. But I said, you know, I'm sorry it didn't work, but I'm glad that you're here and we can still care for you and continue on with the rest of your stroke care while you're in the hospital. The other one was a 36-year-old lady, complex migraine history, maybe strokes in the past, is a questionable history, came down, speech problems, left arm wasn't working, left leg wasn't working. Why aren't the neurology resident was called because of a stroke and not at my request, but came down and then demanded why we weren't in the room taking more better care of this patient, more better care. That's a good English.
Much more better.
That's the kind of care I deliver, much more better. So, and I went and had the conversation and I said, you know, you having a headache too? Yeah. She's like, this is my complex migraine. I can't do it. It's getting better. And the neurology resident was spiking the bag of TPA herself and going to give it. And I said, hold on one second here. Like, we're not going to do it. Let's treat her for her migraine and headache. And 30 minutes later, she had no symptoms. We held the TPA. The neurology resident was unhappy at the time and went to call her attending. Her attending came down. Eventually, the symptoms were resolved. And they said, yeah, she doesn't need TPA. They didn't say thank you for treating the migraine. The patient thanked me, and I was like, oh, good. I'm glad we're all on the same page. And so either way, I think you can be, you know, there's very rare conflicts, but I agree. We're in a system. You have to play by the system rules.
But it sounds like you pick your battles.
Pick your battles. If you think it's going to harm someone, you should step in on those.
And she spiked the bag of TPA, so it was clearly the TPA that made it better.
That's right. I think she atomized it and put it in the nose. I'm not sure. Maybe she put it in her own nose. I mean, I actually took TPA before I rode my bike in here, hoping I could have a clean kill if I fell.
So this is a difficult conversation to have. You know, we have about probably 30 seconds to maybe 2 minutes to establish rapport, and as Chris said, to establish our competency and our caring nature, you know, to the patient. We have to show that we are trying to do what's in their best interest in not much time. This is not Tylenol, as Brian alluded to. This is not broad spectrum antibiotics where maybe you might get an extended beta-lactamase resistant drug in the future. This is not saline versus LR. There's really not a whole lot of drugs like TPA that carry such drastic side effects, and not, you know, rare side effects, but common side effects. I mean, we're giving something to make you bleed. So we often say, if you're going to give TPA to somebody, then make sure that you already have your Foley in, you already have your ART line in, you already have any invasive lines, because if you have to poke, it's going to be a disaster. So if they've already got bleeding, that's going to be rough. So it's a long discussion to have, and I don't think that we all need to put on our tinfoil hats and be, you know, conspiracy theorists, but I think that we need to have a good discussion with the patient and with our consultants, which is probably the thing that we look forward to the least as emergency doctors. We can sometimes say, just move on to the next patient, right? I gotta keep plowing through. And being a little facetious, but
it's not that facetious. From a community standpoint, oh my goodness, is it a lot easier to just write give TPA, move on to the next patient, patients get admitted to neurology, done. And this gets back to the physician who is doing something as opposed to a physician who isn't doing something. Which one gets sued more? The physician that doesn't do something, which one can get on the stand and say, I was doing the best I could for my patient. I went above and beyond. Yeah, it's a little risky, but I wanted to give them the best shot. It's a little bit harder to defend and give a little bit more of an academic discussion about why it's not appropriate.
And we're starting to see less is more, but it's hard, right? The best time is sometimes putting your hands in your pockets, but people want action, right? We're in an instant demand action society. And it is. I am doing a lot less, I'll tell you, Chris, with your, you know, you're talking about neurology comes down, just like with STEMIs. I mean, you used to do a lot more with STEMIs. Now STEMIs like, it's gone 10 minutes, no big thing. Neurology is coming down with a stroke alert or so many stroke systems. Their early involvement, you're out of the picture. You're like, I got 15 other patients I need to go see. I'm not going to sit down and have those conversations all the time. I know what neurology is going to do. I'm not driving this truck, whatever they want to do.
It's moving even more in that direction, right? No, recent policies are saying if neurology isn't there quickly and you've already called them, go ahead and just transfer the patient to their service, and they've given us that approval. So they want to take over quickly.
Yeah. So, difficult conversation to have, and I'll be honest that I kind of kept this on the back burner for a while because I didn't have a firm grasp of the literature, and I knew that there was some controversy about it, and I had a hard time having an educated discussion with patients. But hopefully some of the resources that we provided will help you to be well-educated so that you can have a frank discussion with patients. And strokes are common. So this is a conversation you can work down to a memorized science, just a statement that you read to patients. You can have this on your phone or on your tablet or wherever, just to show them some of the visual aids, because you're going to do this. So like a lot of things that we see, abdominal pain, headaches, chest pain, things that maybe we don't find a good answer to, you're going to have this kind of conversation in your back pocket and say, here's how I'm going to run this. Here's what I'm going to say. Here's how I'm going to explain it as best as I can. And then you can work it, fine-tune it and tweak it as you need to make it how you want to practice, so that it doesn't necessarily have to take 45 minutes to an hour every time you try to discuss it.
And know when you start that conversation, because again, TPA is truly only indicated in a small percentage of all strokes, all comers. And so you can comment quickly that, yes, you're outside the the window. This has been going on for 12 hours. Oh, your symptoms have resolved. You had them for 2 hours. Now they're completely gone. You don't benefit from TPAs. You know, those are quick, easy things. You don't have to have a long discussion on that. But I agree with Aaron. You've got to have that discussion ready to go, or how you want to approach it. And within the system is the best. You know, don't go outside and buck the system. You're only going to get into trouble for doing that. But, you know, talk to the people in charge, which unfortunately right now I feel at a lot of these is the neurologists, and the neurologists are running the stroke centers and running the push for TPA, and partly it's money for the hospital. It's money for the drug. It's expensive. It's $3,000 if the hospital pushes it. It's $3,000 for the drug at least.
So I want to make sure we don't make the neurologists out to be bad people
that are trying
to kill patients. But you think about what neurologists do, and they have a lot of diseases that don't have great outcomes and don't have a lot of treatments. I don't blame them. If I had only a handful of drugs that I thought could have any benefit, I would use them. Because I really want to do the best for my patients. I don't think that they're being stubborn or that they're not caring. I think they're trying to do the best for their patients also, but with very differing perspectives.
And they truly believe the evidence, and they believe the drug works. You know, and they work with reflex hammers and tuning forks, and now all of a sudden we've handed them like a chainsaw, and it's awesome. I mean, they're going crazy. It's a big fancy tool. And if they can make a benefit in someone, like you said, Aaron, I mean, I wouldn't want to be a neurologist. I mean, it's so depressing. Those people do not get better. Seizures don't get better. ALS doesn't get better. But, you know, if they can make strokes better, that's like their happy time. So I get it.
I'm not going to let him get off the hook that easily. When NINS came out in the mid to late 90s, and we had data that showed that we should be giving TPA, guess who was the biggest proponent of it? Emergency physicians. Guess who wasn't giving it? The neurologists. That was one reason why we didn't give it when I was in residency, is because our neurology service was so anti-TPA. And then after all the data comes out that shows that maybe it's not the end-all be-all, emergency physicians are now opposed to it, at least here. And neurology is saying, hey, but there's this study that came out in like the late 90s that showed that TPA is great. Why don't we give it? And, you know, a few years from now, maybe we'll find like a population in which we should select it for. And then they're going to be saying, well, we shouldn't be giving TPA at all. The times, they are changing.
Well, I think we got to make sure the patient doesn't get stuck in the middle, that it's not a battle of consultants. The patient loses when you battle with your consultant. So I think one thing we need to do is tell patients we're happy you came to the emergency department. This is a big deal. We will help you. But the American mindset of I want it fixed now, well, there's a cost of convenience. So.
Hello, everybody. My name is Arthur Smolensky. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Tennessee. We have an emergency medicine residency program here just outside of Nashville. Just started in this group about 10 months ago or so. Prior to that, I worked for 6 years in Scottsdale, Arizona. And ever since I finished residency, I've worked at stroke centers. Currently, my location, I work at two different hospitals, both of which are stroke centers. One has about 90,000 visits. We have a telestroke program, which I'm not a huge fan of. And the other one is about a 50,000 visit ER, which I would consider more of a true stroke center with neurology in-house, what seems like 24/7. Our first facility, every once in a while we do have neurology present, but more often than not, I feel like when I get these stroke cases, I end up, we have to wheel in this machine and the neurologist located somewhere else, including one time I saw he was in his car, pulls over to the side of the road and, you know, does his little spiel, which is pretty interesting, and oftentimes they don't even want us in the room, which I think is a little bit interesting, but it's totally fine. I really enjoyed this podcast. It's really a big topic, and I'm pretty proud of Aaron, who was a lowly little intern when I was a chief resident, for taking this on. Anyway, I did listen to it, and you know, going to give you guys a little bit of my own thoughts on how this is done, where I'm at, my own opinion, and my own belief in the literature and kind of the landscape overall. First off, I think one of the really important things, which I learned when I was a medical student, is that, you know, neurology is a field where there are very, very few treatments for the conditions that they try to take care of. More often than not, all they're doing are just controlling people's symptoms. You know, you compare that to some other fields. You know, you look at ortho, you know, you have a broken bone. They either set it and splint it, or, you know, they take you to the OR and fix it. Urology, you know, somebody comes in with a giant kidney stone, they either do lithotripsy or they put some ureteral stents in. And even cancer, you know, something horrible is happening to people. While, you know, a great majority of those people, depending on the cancer, may do poorly, there are certainly the wins for those guys. I think you compare that to neurology. I was kind of racking my head for any kind of obvious treatable condition that those guys deal with. And, you know, you look at things like ALS, you know, there's really nothing to do. It's progressive. MS, sort of the same thing. Parkinson's and other movement disorders, at best they're controlling the symptoms. They can't really do anything at all to reverse them. And so that obviously brings up strokes. Sort of the same thing. I don't think they're the bad guys in this, but I just sort of feel like they're helpless and they're just trying to do the best they can to help people. This is a topic that I've been interested in to varying degrees, and we're working on some stuff at my facilities to also make this better. One of the things my own review of this literature, you know, shows me that about 15% of people that we diagnose as strokes and who get treated with TPA are actually, they turn out to be stroke mimics. That's a huge number if you think about it. It's about 1 in 7 that were given TPA to who do poorly. This was based on a study out of Memphis, Tennessee. And interestingly, the point of it was to sort of show that giving TPA to stroke mimics was safe. And so that's a whole different discussion. But I think if you're giving TPA, a drug that we know has, you know, 6 to 7% risk of intracranial hemorrhage, to a drug that we have no way to reverse, I don't think that's the case. I think one of the biggest issues and concerns that I find with treating strokes altogether is just simply, we don't really have a confirmatory test. You know, I know on the podcast these guys talked about, you know, STEMI and, you know, people giving TPA for that. And, you know, I've moonlit at some really random small little places, and you sort of just start the TPA because that's the best that you have. But, you know, we at least have an EKG and troponin to kind of help guide those decisions. In stroke, we don't have a test. All we have is sort of, we don't have bleeding in the brain, but there's nothing typically on that CT scan that's going to tell us, hey, you know what? This is a stroke. This is the person you should, you know, be going for. I think that's really worrisome. A little bit like Brian, I think I have a little bit of a tinfoil hat as to the business of medicine and healthcare in general. I know you guys recently are now part of the Banner University Medical Center, and that giving you your own little dose of how healthcare is potentially changing and perhaps not for the better. And, you know, most of the positive trials that we found that say, hey, we should be giving TPA to people, those are funded by Genentech, and obviously those guys have their own reason for wanting us to give those medications. I do think it's important to note that the last time I looked at this, you know, if you crack open a bottle of TPA and don't give it, Genentech will fully refund the pharmacy their money, because obviously they can't bill the patient for it. And that just kind of is just stuff that they do to kind of help push people to give this drug. You know, there was a discussion about lawsuits and being sued, and I had previously heard that you were just as likely to be sued whether you did or didn't give it. So I took a look at some of the literature myself, a little bit of a refresher, if you will. And, you know, the study that I found, and I think it was the one that was referenced on the podcast, they only found 38 lawsuits total. And that's really a small number to really draw any conclusions on. To be fair, those studies did show that not giving it was more likely to cause you to get sued. But I think when you really look at it on a more realistic basis, the people who are getting TPA, who are admitted with a ischemic stroke, that number is only about 1.3% of those. And as they studied more and more, they found that they were giving more and more TPA, and the highest they got to was about 2.4%, or roughly 1 in 40 of your ischemic strokes. And so surely, with that lawsuit data, just the fact that anybody was sued for giving TPA would, you know, sort of just skew it one way or the other. So I don't think we can really make any fair and honest evidence-based judgment on that. I think the reality, and kind of more practically speaking, I'll tell you guys a little bit about what I do. As I sort of have 6 years of working without residents, and now, depending which facility I'm at, I'm either making the decision by myself or having my residents kind of go on board. I will tell you that here in the Nashville area, our neurologists are incredibly brave and very willing to give TPA, and they are pushing it like it's going out of style. It's something that I'm not terribly comfortable with. I did give it not infrequently when I was in Scottsdale, but it's much more so here. I think the reality is the data is questionable at best. I think when you really look at it, the risks are high. The benefit is questionable because the way the studies are done is questionable. And I think because of that, you just need to use your shared decision making. It's something I'm a big fan of with a lot of my cardiac patients, and I think with this drug, I think it's a key component to A, not getting sued, but perhaps more importantly, just letting patients make their own decisions. I think you need to have neurology on board. I know Chris, who I also, he trained after me, you know, mentioned where he worked, he was just given TPA, you know, without neuro on board. I think that's not something that I'm comfortable with. That's not something that I would do. I think this really needs to be handled a lot more like the way we handle our STEMIs. We sort of stabilize the patient, we sort of confirm it, and then we send them off to cardiology to do kind of what they want. And I think it should be that way with neurology. My old hospital, we had a stroke team. There was a stroke nurse, and she came down and sort of handled a lot of the stuff. And I think if lawsuits are your concern, that's by far the best model to kind of keep you out of it. Let them sort of deal with it. Let them sort it out. And that's really not how I typically handle things, but I think the data on this is so poor, and you know, you're playing a really, really high stakes game with no great answer. I think it's best to have, you know, more than one person involved in making the decision. On another note, I thought I would give you guys a couple of quick little stories, if you will, about cases I had. You know, we're getting push from our stroke team, and I put that in air quotes, and the hospital about meeting different metrics and all this other stuff, and it's a whole big deal. And I had this guy come in. He was about 80, and he had a facial droop, and he had some bilateral upper extremity weakness, and you know, the guy just didn't seem right. And the charge nurse, who's a great nurse, is like, hey, should we get some TPA? I said, well, look, you know, they want to take him to the CT. I said, let's at least get a sugar. And lo and behold, the guy's sugar is 40. And this kind of gets to the stroke mimics. You know, we probably would have found that even if at that, you know, moment that she asked me, I had said, you know, for us to get the TPA, but you're really putting people at risk. We had another incident where one of the other doctors I work with here got into, you know, verbal fight with the neurologist because he felt that the patient didn't want TPA, and the neurologist really felt like the patient would benefit from it. And, you know, you sort of, you want to avoid those issues and those fights in front of patients, but they're real, and it is our job to kind of stand up for them. I think my personal biggest thing with the TPA discussion is that the studies don't make sense. You can't have all these different studies, no matter what their outcomes are, and you don't really have a conclusion. And when you don't have a conclusion, to me, that to me is a negative study, meaning that, you know, they can't find the benefit. You know, they're looking hard for it. And I think it's important to also note that, you know, these people who are running these trials, they're going to do it better they're going to have a whole system set up better than what you're going to have where you guys are at, and for sure where I'm at. And so those are the things that, kind of really concern me with all of what we have going on. Lastly, and I don't think they mentioned it, but they're just wanted to let all you trainees know, there is a body of research coming out with these clot retrievers, and they look pretty positive. And actually, I think one of the big benefits for them is that, you know, they're really looking at sort of the sickest of the sick patients, and they're finding positive outcomes. And I think that's a really good thing. And, you know, they're using CT perfusion and other studies to sort of confirm what it is that they're looking for. And I think, you know, once we can kind of do that, I think we're in a place where we can really do some benefit for our patients. The trial, if I hadn't mentioned it already, is the Mr. Clean trial. There were three others that were done all at about the same time. Anyway, thanks for listening to me ramble on. You guys hope are doing great out there. You have some great guys to teach you, and that's it. Thanks so much.